This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Hi, I'm Nick Ravelis, the Geisel Director of Education and Outreach for San Diego Opera. As you know, we have a number of opportunities for you to get to know opera and our current season by tuning in here to UCSD-TV. One of our most exciting offerings is Stars in the Salon. This series is an opportunity for you, our audience, to meet the singers, the conductors, and the stage directors who create our productions. Taped before a live audience, the artists discuss their roles, the music, and the stories behind the operas. It's especially entertaining and informative for those of you who are new to opera. Join us now for Stars in the Salon, and I'll see you at the opera. Today's subject, of course, is La Fille du Régiment, The Daughter of the Regiment by Gaetano Donizetti. It premiered in 1840. It was one of six, count them, six operas that Donizetti had playing at the same time in Paris at some of the various opera theaters in that wonderful city. I don't believe they have eight or nine opera theaters anymore, but the Opéra Comique still exists, which was the theater at which this opera premiered. I'd like to introduce our artists tonight, beginning directly on my right. American tenor Stephen Costello was with us for two seasons in a row, 2010 as Romeo and 2011 as Faust, made his Met debut in 2007 as Arturo in Lucia, and then was invited to open the 2011-2012 Met season as Lord Percy in Anna Bolena. He's now sung at Covent Garden, Vienna, the Salzburg Festival, Glyndebourne, and all sorts of places. His roles include Rodolfo, Nemorino, Lester, the Duke of Mantua, and he created, of course, the role of Greenhorn in Moby Dick. Tenor Stephen Costello. And I neglected to tell you that he will, of course, be singing the role of Tonio. Our maestro, Franco-Canadian conductor Yves Abel, is principal guest conductor at the Deutsche Oper Berlin, a regular guest at the Vienna Staatsoper, and a frequent guest at the Royal Opera, Covent Garden, La Scala, the Met, Lyric Opera Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle, Glyndebourne, Paris Opera, and many, many more. In 2009, he received the title Chevalier de l'Ordre des Arts et des Lettres by the French government. Yves Abel. You'll have to correct me on my French pronunciation. And then in the middle of the table is Slovakian soprano Lubica Vargicová, who sings the role of Marie. She was last here in Rigoletto as Gilda. She is was for many years, I think, at the Slovak National Theater. She's sung at the Metropolitan Opera, the Salzburg Festival, Vienna State Opera. Her roles include The Queen of the Night, Violetta, Gilda, Lucia, Olympia, and many more. And so she is, of course, singing the role of Marie, Lubica Vargicová. And next to her is her translator, Elena Batson. Elena, thank you for joining us and helping us out. Polish contralto Ewa Podlesz made her San Diego Opera debut in the title role of Julius Caesar in Egypt in 2006. She has sung in all the great companies of the world, Covent Garden, Opéra Comique, Canadian Opera Company, the Grand Théâtre del Liceu in Barcelona, L'Opéra de Monte Carlo, San Francisco, the Met. Her roles include Adalgisa, Erda, Ulrika, Tancredi, Mistress Quickly, The Princess in Suor Angelica, and many more. Ava, welcome back to San Diego. Spanish stage director Emilio Sacchi is making his San Diego Opera debut. He's the former general director of the Zarzuela Theater in Madrid and the former artistic director of the Teatro Real in Madrid. He is currently artistic director of the Teatro Arriaga in Bilbao. He's directed at the Maggio Musicale Fiorentino, Florida Grand Opera, Los Angeles Opera, Teatro an der Wien in Vienna, Washington National, Houston Grand Opera, and the Teatro Municipal de Santiago de Chile, among many more. Emilio, welcome. And then finally, also making his debut with San Diego Opera, American-based Kevin Burdett. In the role of Sergeant Sulpice, he will soon be making his Met debut as Stefano in Thomas Ade's opera, The Tempest. He's sung with the Gotham Chamber Opera, the Opera Company of Philadelphia, Lyric Opera Kansas City, Virginia Opera, Santa Fe, and the Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. His roles include Bartolo in Barber, Coco in The Mikado, I'd love to see that, Nick Shadow in The Rake's Progress, Colina, Osmin, and he recently sang Leporello in the Los Angeles Philharmonic's performances of Don Giovanni. Kevin Burdett. Now, admittedly, sitting down to study this opera and think about things that I would say to audiences about it, I have to say that I really thought this has probably the most unlikely of background backstories of just about any opera, that a French regiment of soldiers is trudging around during the Napoleonic Wars and come upon an infant baby girl on the battlefield and pick her up and raise her as their own. And so she becomes la fille du régiment, the daughter of the regiment. About 3 days after I started thinking about that, an article came across the Associated Press about a Polish regiment of soldiers in southern Afghanistan who were on, you know, what do they call, maneuvers, and came upon a little package. They were afraid it might be an IED, so they approached it very carefully, but it started to move, and it was indeed an infant baby girl. And they took it immediately to a hospital, got it formula and diapers, named the girl Pola, which I think is lovely, and then didn't leave the hospital until they were sure that this little girl would be adopted by a young Afghan couple, which she was late in that very day. Opera sometimes isn't quite as fanciful as we think it is. It was just amazing to me. And the only thing different is that they, of course, didn't take her along for the rest of their battles and raise her as their own. But in this opera, it's 18 years later or so, and she's ready for love, and the fathers, the entire regiment of soldiers, have to decide how they're going to deal with a mature young woman who's falling in love. I want to begin by talking for a bit to our maestro, Eva Bell. First of all, about Donizetti. Here's this young Italian composer, Donizetti, who has a great reputation in Italy but wants to make a splash in Paris, which, of course, is where you have to, I think that the other, there you go, that's closer.
Hello?
Where at the time, in 1840, you have to make a splash in Paris, right? It's the capital of opera at that time. So in this opera, how does Donizetti, who's fully engulfed in the traditions of Italian opera, write for a French audience? Is this an Italian opera with a French accent or a French opera with an Italian accent?
Well, this is a really good question. The fact is that this opera by this Italian guy turned out to be the major influence for practically every French opera that came after it, every kind of comic opera that came after it. So in the plays on words and the kind of irony that he uses in the text, but also in that mix between a kind of comedic, farcical element mixed with the sort of pathos of Marie's first aria at the end of Act One. So you've got two sides. You've got the both sides of opera at the time. You've got the comic opera, which everybody loved to revel in these kind of military tunes and these catchy, kind of fabulous, kind of catchy tunes. And then on the other side, you've got the other side of opera, which is, you know, the beautiful, languid, long melodies of Donizetti. So he couldn't fail.
Well, and I find it interesting, too, that he knew the language well enough to be able to write very well for French, right?
Well, I think the reason for that is because, like Verdi, he had spent a lot of time there. I mean, that was the place to make it as a composer. Mm-hmm. You know, that's where they made the most money. The example of Rossini, several years before, who had come to Paris to become a star, and became a star to the point where he had such a huge retirement pension from the French government that he didn't have to write a single other opera for the rest of his life, and he lived another 40 years or something like that. So I think, you know, everybody wanted to make it in Paris. That was the place to be, and so he had spent some time there, as you mentioned, of course, with his other Italian operas, because there was an Italian theater in Paris, where the Théâtre des Italiens, where all of his operas were being performed at the same time. And then, of course, he wanted to make that crossover so he could really be crowned by not only performing in Italian theater, but also in the French-speaking theater.
Mm-hmm. Emilio, how do you approach directing an operatic comedy like The Daughter of the Regiment, as opposed to one of Donizetti's serious operas or tragedies like Lucia or Anna Bolena?
Well, I think the approaching of this comedy, as Maestro says, is completely different of Lucia de Lammermoor or Anna Bolena or another opera of Donizetti. First of all, you have to approach a very, very funny story, very nice story, full of nostalgia and full of comic situation and very, very light situation, comic light situation. It's not a comic big. It's a comic full of French spirit of champagne bubbles and mm-hmm. and it's you have to follow this kind of music and this kind of plot and also. It could be a little, I don't know the word in English, in Spanish is cursi. Is cursi is a little silly, like a tale for children. And I think that for that reason, I change the times and I don't do it in the Napoleon epoch because I think close to us is more similar to one of so many films, the images of so many American films, musicals, that they did in America in the 60s, in the 70s, with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Debbie Reynolds, this lady that is a soldier, and then it's more this image more close to us, more close to our times. Make that more real, more at the same time most touching. If you do it in the Napoleon times and all that, you see it like puppets, I think you don't enjoy the nice story and the wonderful sense of humor, very fine, very very classy at the same time. And I try to follow all these lines in my production.
Well, it's updated to the end of World War II. Are we still in Paris?
No. Where are we? It's in a little village of France.
Ah, okay. But not in Switzerland, but in France.
No, in Switzerland. The regiment is American. It's American soldiers. And the fille du regiment, she's American too. And the boyfriend Antonio he is French in that case. We change a little bit two or three words of the score. Well, that the, we could do it.
And I am American.
Yeah, you are French, darling.
She's American. Maria.
She's American because she's a mother.
Captain Robert.
Yeah, Captain we'll allow Robert. Them to continue with their private conversation. I'd like to turn to Stephen and Lubitsa to address the same question, because both of you have sung the serious operas of Donizetti. Stephen, most recently, Anna Bolena, you were Lord Percy. And I know Lubitsa has sung Lucia in Lucia di Lammermoor. Is this a different composer? Are the vocal demands different in this comedy than they are in the tragic works? Let's start with Stephen.
Yeah, I think, I mean, they're completely different styles of singing for me anyway. I mean, I talk with Maestro all the time about Daughter of Regiment compared to, say, Lucia. It's a lighter, I mean, a lighter way of singing. I think for me, the Daughter of Regiment, the style of singing almost borderlines Rossini in a way. You have to use a lighter approach and a lighter attack in order to have as much flexibility when you're singing and more, especially when you do the coloratura passages or things like that. You have to have a lighter side of your voice, or you're not going to get through it, and you're going to take too much weight up with you. And for me, it's been a learning experience, because I just came from singing Bohème, which is much, much heavier, and then having to take a whole new approach to this, it's like I'm back in school again. So, yeah, but I think it's completely different. I mean, to me, the closest thing to this that I would sing Donizetti-wise is Elixir of Love. Uh-huh. And even Elixir of Love has a heavier tenor can sing that. Mm-hmm. So this is a learning experience for me. It really is. Mm-hmm.
Lubitsa, what about you? What are the differences in the vocal demands between a role like Lucia and the role of Marie?
It's a big difference. Because Lucia I was singing earlier, and I had a feeling that it was the most dramatic role I received.
Ale paradoxne, keď som dostala ponuku na dceru Puku.
But when I get this offer for Daughter of the Regiment,
už teda viac rokov
naspäť, years ago, few years ago,
tak som vlastne zistila, že aj táto rola ma pekne vie potrápiť.
I find out it's also this role is not easy for me.
A práve preto, že sa tam kladie veľký dôraz na recitatívy a na takú ekvilibristiku.
Because I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with this. Recitatives. There is the recitatives. Are very important.
Yes,
recitatives are very important. And what is the next word? And it has a lot of colorful passages.
A coloratura. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, in fact, this is an opera comique, so it has spoken dialogue. And I think one of my questions, I want to turn to Kevin for this, because I think you have quite a bit of spoken dialogue, do you not, in this...
Yeah,
in this opera,
substantial amount.
And isn't there is it difficult to shift from speaking mode to singing mode? Do you have to really sort of think about that and place your voice?
You know, that's a good idea. I might should think about that.
I'm glad to help.
I actually don't. I think one runs the risk, especially in a lovely but large space. Like this, with the dialogue of sort of a feeling like you have to really make a lot of sound. Like you almost have to develop, I imagine, a technique for speaking, because otherwise you start doing this and it's you're taxing yourself and it's not comprehensible. Of course, it's in French, so my French may not be comprehensible anyway.
Stephen, do you have anything to say about the moving from? From speaking to
I'm thankful that they cut my dialogue down. I think Emilio said it best in rehearsal. It's when you first come on the scene after a musical number, I mean, initially the dialogue would start out louder, but then you bring the audience into what you're saying on stage, so you're not shouting the whole time. And I think the way that it's being staged and the way that I think everybody has been doing it in rehearsal, I mean, you're not going to miss one line from anywhere in the house. I think everyone's doing a great job with it.
That's a good point.
Eva, your repertoire includes so many serious roles like Erda, Tancredi, Cesare, Ulrica. Do you enjoy playing comedy, and have you had much opportunity to do comedy?
Not that much. I like to think to play comedy, but really in my life, I prefer much more dramatic roles, mm-hmm. you know. So when I am not anymore 20 years old, so it's time to sing, to change my repertory and to sing something different. I mean, old witches, like Erda, Ulrika, Madame de l'Altier, stepmother in Cinderella by Massenet. Even Marquisa de Berkenfield is, it's, but I feel okay with both, you know. I feel on stage like fish in water. I was born on stage. My mother was a singer in choir in Warsaw Opera House. So really, I was born on stage. Then I am on stage already 57 years.
Wow. Yeah.
But I play on stage 57 years. My first role, it was Madame Butterfly's Baby. Yes. Yes, then I was in children choir, and I was a super. So I have experience on stage. It doesn't matter what I think. I have always something to tell.
Wonderful. Lubica, again, you sing many difficult coloratura roles. Is Marie easier to sing than the other? Like, you sing Queen of the Night, for instance, which I imagine is tremendously difficult to come out and sing that and to really nail that first aria. Even the second one after a little warm-up must be difficult. But is Marie as challenging, or is it a little easier for you?
Easy.
Každá ďalšia rola, ktorú som spievala, bola nová výzva a mala niečo ťažké v sebe.
Every new role I sing is a challenge for me. And it was somehow difficult for me.
A samozrejme, nedá sa porovnať Kráľovná noci a Dcéra pulku.
We cannot compare the roles.
Queen of the Night.
Queen of the Lights of the Daughter of the Regiment.
Ale obidve majú v sebe niečo veľmi náročné. Každá iným spôsobom.
But both of them, they are somehow difficult, each different way.
A Mária je práve pre mňa najťažšie.
In Mária, the most difficult part is...
Tak ako povedal tuto Kevin, spojiť hovorené slovo s ospievaným.
Just as was told by Kevin, that it's very difficult to combine the words with the singing and talking.
A takisto prejsť z tej komediálnej polohy do takej tej melodramatickej v tých pomalých áriách.
And also the transformation from the comedy, like comic role, to the melodramatic role.
Maestro, brings up an interesting question. It's actually not one of my official questions, but in the recording, of course, of this, the classical recording, is the one conducted by Richard Bonning, who's been here many, many times, sung by Joan Sutherland and Luciano Pavarotti. It must be about 40 years old by now at this point. And at the beginning of Chacun le sait, there is this cadenza that she treats as a kind of reveille, like a fanfare.
Fanfare.
A military fanfare. But after looking at the score, it's not in the score. It's completely free, isn't it? What the soprano can do to introduce this yeah. aria. What are we going to hear?
Well,
and what have you heard in the past? I mean, do different singers take different approaches to
this?
They
do. They do, and it depends on the production. In this particular production, Emilio's chosen, you know, for her to come out there, and she's kind of reluctant. You know, she's probably been asked to do this 5,000 times because the guys in the regiment are all, yeah, yeah, go and sing again, yeah. And she's like, oh, not again. So, but we in this case, we tried different things, and then finally we settled on the tried and true because it is really so appropriate to the moment. And it also contrasts so much with the beginning of the aria. So if you do this really trumpet-like kind of fanfare, and then right after you start, and then you draw the audience in with a quiet beginning, you know, has that great sort of contrasting. But in general, Donizetti and all the bel canto composers would write this big fermata. You know, fermata means this big kind of arc with a dot in the middle, and that says, okay, here you can do whatever you want to do, mm-hmm. basically in the style. And what's difficult is that Donizetti and Rossini had different styles for those improvisatory moments, and so did Verdi, and so did other composers. So all of them have really completely different languages, if you wish. And it's our job, in a way, to kind of do something that's, you know, hopefully is close to that particular composer's.
Yeah. Ms. Potlesch brought up an interesting point, and that was that, you know, how her career began, practically born on the stage. I'd like to start with Kevin and ask you, how did you get into the world of singing? How did you start?
That's a good question. I started a handful of times. I sort of start and stop and start and stop. But I'm the youngest of five kids, grew up in Tennessee, and my siblings before me all sort of went toward professional school, but they always sort of had music. There was always music around the house, and because I was the youngest and sort of the black sheep, I caught the music bug and started, you know, doing high school plays, and then that grew into doing stuff at college. And next thing you knew, I was sort of thinking, wait, you know, maybe music and singing isn't just an avocation. Maybe it's something you could sort of make a life out of. I spent a year in Vienna, and that was very influential because you sort of saw it right in front of you. Music is sort of in the blood of Vienna, and you're like, oh, wow, this isn't just something you have to do on the side.
Mm. Emilio, how did you begin stage directing, especially stage directing opera and Zarzuela?
Well, it was a big influence of my family. My grandfather was singer of Zarzuela, very famous Emilio Sacibarba. Well, my name is Emilio for him. And then my uncle, Sacibela, also. So he was very, very famous in Spain. And also he sang in USA, I think, in the television of the times, that in the 50s. It was the first programs of the television, something like that. And in my family, always, I hear the music. And then, well, I think in life, the azar is always very important. And sometimes you go to a station, and instead of taking one train, you take the train for another part. And it was my case. I studied philosophy and humanities in Spain, and then I read my doctoral thesis in that, and it was the first thesis between two literature and music. And well, I do theater in the university and all that, and then at the end I have a grant to study musicology in the University of London in Senate House. And when I come back, I was involved in opera in Spain, in my city, in Madrid, and then they asked me to do my first, well, many, many years ago. Mm. And I did Traviata, and then I did Macbeth next year, and then they invited me to debut in Madrid in the Teatro, the Opera House in Madrid was in that moment was Teatro de la Zarzuela, because Teatro Real was open in 97. And I did Don Pasquale, Juan Donizetti, was my first in Madrid, important with a big cast and with a very important new production. And then my next was La Fanciulla del West, Puccini, and I was Plácido Domingo singing. And when I have a very good people that helped me so much in my career, was Plácido, one of them, and also Montserrat Caballé, that I did with her in 87. I did Mephistopheles. She was singing Margarita, and she picked me up to the Liceu, and Plácido picked me up to Los Angeles, and I started to do that. But I think it was by Azar. I never...
Thank you to
us. Yes. and I never... think when I was a youngster, a teenager, that I'm going to direct. I would like to sing, but well, it's obvious that I couldn't.
Now we heard from Eva Lubitsa. How about you? How did you start your career?
I studied as a child. At the music school.
Takže to bolo vlastne, to bol prvý chlapec z čarovnej flauty, tak to povedal.
It was the first boy in the from magic flute.
A potom som vlastne dostávala ponuky počas vysokej školy a to bol môj začiatok v Slovenskom národnom.
And then during my university studies, I received the offers. During my studies in Slovak National Opera for the small roles.
A hneď po skončení vysokej školy som vlastne, by som povedala, tak húpla do vysokých postav.
When I finished my university, I just started a big roles. The first big engagement I received in Switzerland, in Bern, where I was Lucia from La Merma. La Mermur. So that was the start. It was 20 years ago.
Not so long. Great. Maestro, how about yourself?
Thank you. Well, I'm learning a lot about my colleagues here tonight. This is very interesting. And I'm glad to know that I'm not the only frustrated singer on this stage who's not singing presently. I myself started off as a singer, actually, as a boy soprano in a choir in Canada, in Toronto. And I was lucky enough to be chosen to sing in opera. And I got to sing with some pretty big name singers pretty early on, did some CDs, did a lot of TV and radio and all that. And then, as you know, the voice changes at a certain age. And then you're in this sort of period of a flux. You don't know what's going to happen to your voice. You don't know how it's going to settle in the end. Well, after taking lessons for several years, it clearly turned out that it was not going to be much of a Pavarotti there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I would be lucky to be a bad Compromario. So the writing was on the wall, and I was playing the piano at the same time, and things went very well, playing and accompanying a lot of singers, a lot of instrumentalists. At the same time, started to dabble in conducting a little bit. But with the singing experience and the playing for singers a lot, it kind of was a natural extension to be the conductor with some experience with orchestras. And in New York, where I had been a student, I started a small opera company that did French operas. And within the space of like 3 or 4 years, I had these shocks of being asked to conduct in pretty big places. And so it sort of snowballed in that way, and it was really, you know, like Emilio said, just one of those things that you get on the train, and hopefully that train goes in, you know, the road not taken, the famous poem by Robert Frost. And, well, that's the way it is.
Is it exclusively opera, or do you do orchestral concerts?
I do a lot of orchestral concerts now. It's probably about 60, 40, 70, 30, something like that. But more opera. That's where my heart really lies.
You prefer, yeah. Okay, great. And Stephen?
Well, I joined the chorus in high school mostly to get out of class, but it kind of backfired because they rehearsed at 7 in the morning before school.
Ooh.
Yeah, it sucked. So I figured if I had to be there, right, I might as well try to sing louder than the guy next to me. And I think through then I kind of just found out that I had a voice and that I enjoyed singing, just, you know, getting up every morning. I mean, to get up at 6:30 to go and sing, you must like it, right? So I decided to do it in undergrad, and I went to undergrad at a small school in Philadelphia called University of the Arts, where I studied mostly musical theater type music because I was still trying to figure out what I liked to sing. And it's mostly because classical music intimidated me, because I really didn't have a technique, because I had never taken lessons up until undergrad. Probably my third year at undergrad, I decided, I'm going to start looking into opera, looking into arias and some songs, and I enjoyed it. I listened to Fritz von Lilich for the first time, and it kind of just blew me over the edge. And from then on, I wanted to study opera or study classical music. And I auditioned for AVA when I finished undergrad, which is where I started my operatic training. And I got with my teacher at ABA, and I spent 4 years there and graduated when I was 24 or 25, and I, 25, 26, debuted at the Met and basically went on to a career from there.
But that was only, like, 2 years ago, right?
Right. Yeah. No, I think it was, what was it, 5 years ago? No, 6 years ago? Five, 6 years ago?
Oh, don't tell us. Keep it a mystery. Keep it a mystery.
6 months ago. Ian heard me singing on the street and then hired me for this.
We have this is another opera where you've got three stock characters. You've got the typical ingenue, you've got the typical hero, the young tenor, and you've got the typical father. Stock characters have been around, I think, since the era of the Commedia dell'arte. I just want to open it up to all of you. When you're portraying a stock character like that, like the blustery father who sort of stands in between the destiny between the young man and the young woman, or you play the young man or the young woman, how do you make those stock characters interesting? How do you approach them differently so that the audience will accept them as something real or as something beyond that typical stock character?
This actually is not a good answer. It may be secondarily a good answer. The approach may be not believing it's a stock character, because I don't see Sul Piece as being the stock character at all. It's not a sort of Bart. It's not. It doesn't come from the. I mean, it's sort of tangentially, I would guess. I defer to the smart guys, but it may be tangentially related to Commedia characters, but it's not the typical sort of Bartolo character who loves Rosina and she's his ward and he wants to be with her and wants to marry her and he interferes. Rather, he almost immediately, he has no designs on, what I mean, he Sul Piece has no designs on Marie, nor does he interfere particularly with the courtship of Tonio and Marie. She says, this is what happens, and Sul Piece goes, okay, sounds good. So that, on the primary level, is probably not a very helpful answer, but on a secondary level, it might be helpful insofar as one way to approach a stock character is not to look at it stock at all, and sort of as a stock character at all, and rather to see what is it about this particular character and this particular fantastic production that's been updated and has a relevance, a historical relevance to me as an American, mm-hmm. and has a cultural relevance, talking about the sort of the Gene Kelly movies and the Fred Astaire movies that have a sort of Fred Astaire moment over on the side at one point, and it's sort of seeing what is particular about this production and this role that is unique unto itself rather than stock.
Mm-hmm. Well, he is the person that has to remind Marie of the rules, that she can't marry outside of the regiment,
yes.
that her father, in other words, the entire regiment, has to agree before she marries, correct?
It's true.
So that seems to me to be, maybe it's not the typical father who's, you know,
telling them that they can't marry, but he has to be there in the middle of it all and say, but wait a minute, right?
Sure. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is informed, I would say, the role. I mean, I have no doubt that Donizetti was informed by the Commedia tradition, and the character is informed by, the character of Sulpice is informed by the traditional stock, sort of. Is it the Pantalone? Who is the...
Pantalone.
Yeah, the Pantalone is informed by that, and there are certainly aspects of it, but it's pretty immediate that Marie says, whoa, you found this, the regiment comes in and says, we have found a traitor. And she goes, hold on, whoa, don't do anything to this guy, he's the guy that saved my life. And the regiment goes, what are you talking about? And I go, yeah, it's true. Like, immediately. And I think it's sweeter, it's more endearing, because it means that there is no sort of secondary motivation for Sulpice vis-a-vis Marie. It's that he loves her, and he is a father figure, and he wants her to be happy. And it's a very endearing twist on a stock character, mm-hmm. insofar as it's like, oh, gosh, I want you to be happy. There are these rules. And, oh, I understand where the Marquise is coming from, and you might... It's a very paternal, as opposed to sort of skeevy relationship, which I think Bartolo is kind of skeevy. Yeah. In a good way. Listen, I love playing skeevy, don't get me wrong.
Well, Don Pasquale is much more in the Commedia tradition.
Yeah, precisely. Pasquale's idea, precisely.
The daughter, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can see those Commedia characters in everyone that's in it. And it's interesting that we did indeed have Don Pasquale last year. I think it's only maybe 3 years later or 4 years later that he wrote Don Pasquale. Is that right, Maestro?
Yes. His last opera.
But it's a larger orchestra, is it not?
It's about the same size orchestra. It's just that the trombones play all the time in Don Pasquale. Whereas in La Fille du Régiment, it's a little bit more sparse.
Eva, with the orchestra, you've never had any problem cutting through an orchestra, having heard you as Giulio Cesare, both in Canada at the Canadian Opera Company and here when we did it in, I guess it was 2006. No problem cutting through an orchestra. Had ever had a problem? Has it always been a voice that can cut through?
No. Of course I had problems when I was young and beautiful. 20 kilos younger. My voice was completely different and kind of... So when the agent proposed me, for example, Ulrika or Azucena, I said, are you crazy? Azucena? Never in my life, maybe in 30 years. And now it happened. In 30 years, but earlier my voice was very light. Of course, I had always 3 octaves and flexibility, no problem with this, but with project, I had problems, but I didn't do nothing to push, to make my voice bigger in that moment that I had, so... everything goes on the right way. So now I can still sing with healthy voice. I never damaged my voice. I never pushed to do something against me. I never sang a repertory not for me, even if it was written for mezzo. I always had to check, is it really, really can sing this? And now, step by step, after when I brought my daughter to this world, my voice became darker, bigger, without any effort, you know. Just naturally.
And this isn't strange. I mean, voices do change over a career.
Yes, of course, and not only my voice. I think it's natural way, if nobody will disturb to do something wrong, it's natural that voice change becomes much more mature and yes.
I have to say, though, going to the first music rehearsal last week, I heard you sing your aria at the top of Act One. It's really the first aria that we hear is Madame Marquise de Birkenfeld. You have some of the lowest notes I've ever heard come out of a female body in my life. What was that, a low D?
B.
Dear sweet Lord. Yeah. I mean, it's really surprising. I mean, it is immediately striking. It also, I think, it's not just a trick. It tells us a lot about the character, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. It's you know, the role of the Marquisa de Birkenfeld is generally considered as a secondary role, and I am not agree with this opinion.
of course.
I would never accept a secondary role if it were not important for the drama of the plot. Like the Marquisa de Birkenfeld is placed between such a secondary roles like Ulrika, like La Cieca in Gioconda, like Contess in the Queen of Spades. And Madame de Laltier in Cendrillon, Cinderella by Massenet. So for me, I'm sorry, forgive me, my colleagues. But for me, Marquisa de Birkenfeld is the most important and the most interesting character in this opera. Huh? Because, you know, she opens and she closes this story. Without her, the intrigue wouldn't exist. The entire story is driven by what she has made in her youth, what she is doing right now, and what she will decide about the future. So, of course, to compare, I have much less to think to compare with tenor Tonio and with Maria soprano, but as a character, it's really very, very strong personality. It's easy to sing, but it's not too easy to play Marquisa de Birkenfeld, because I have to show many faces of her personality, and she's rather complicated. Mm-hmm. An exalted aristocrat, always impressed by wealth, fortune, titles, a woman who doesn't afraid men. She likes men. She's even ready to make a relationship with Sergeant Sulpice. And why not? She's alone, he's alone. We have daughter. So I think, and but I think she's not happy person, because the only she loved was probably killed during the war, and you know, she's very courageous, but she had courage to connect her life with this of famous Captain Robert, but she had no courage to raise her daughter, and I think this is her huge complex. And when she finally finds Maria, she's ashamed to reveal that she's her mother. And she pretends to be her aunt. But at the end, she's of course intelligent and honest, and in the most decisive moment for Maria, Marquisa shows her immense sensibility, warm and devoted heart, and she makes the only possible correct decision without a fear of the reaction of the aristocrat society she belongs to. And at the end, we have happy end, because Marquisa finally doesn't afraid. She's natural. She doesn't want to destroy Maria's life, and she takes right decision, and everybody are happy. Thanks, Marquisa, the American here. Ah. Who is most important on stage?
I should always remind the artists before we do these artist roundtables not to reveal the ending of the opera. People who have never seen it before, now it's been completely revealed. Anyway, do we have a little bit of time for questions from the audience, if anyone has questions. Yes.
I think I tried this one on you, Nick. In the update, Emilio, how do you handle the fact that it's an American regiment? How did they acquire this infant and raised her? Because that sort of wasn't done during World War II.
We didn't understand. Translate.
Oh, I will translate into English.
Yes. Yeah.
The question was, this is an American regiment in the update. And it strains credulity. It's hard to believe that a regiment in World War II would adopt an infant baby girl from the battlefield. So how do you explain that?
Oh, well, this is but that I think is very difficult to understand anyway in the Napoleonic times too. It's in the army of the emperor is very difficult to understand. I think that this is a kind of comedy, and we don't know what happened before, and we don't know when they adopted this lady, how it happened. Donizetti doesn't tell us nothing in the libretto, and maybe it's a girl that he has no parents, and the regiment adopted her for not as father, but maybe as a protected or something like that. I don't know. I don't analyze very well, because also during Napoleonic times is so difficult to understand that a regiment of soldiers, they could have the permission of the law permit that they have a fee, a daughter, a lady, a little girl in the surely not. Well, in all the armies, I don't know, nor even in Roman times would be permitted. I'm sure the discipline of the military. I think that also is so complicated to understand nowadays then in Napoleonic times or in the army of the Spanish Empire with Felipe II, and it's unbelievable in the headquarters to have a little girl. And for that reason, I didn't analyze very much that subject. When you see it, the plot. I do it twice. This opera, two different production. My first production, I did it in Monte Carlo Opera, and then it was in Madrid and Rome and now it's in the Dusseldorf Opera, and I did it in the times, in the Napoleonic times. I did it with a big, very famous painter that is a friend of mine, Fernando Botero. You surely know. Well, in that production, the thing was that all the people was very fat, because Fernando, you know that he likes the volumes of the round people, and it was very problematic for the singers, because nowadays the singers, they are very thin, and they have to play the opera with bibendum, with a big bibendum. And I saw that when I did my second, that they charged me to do it at Teatro Comunale de Bologna, because was very funny, because we are friends, Juan Diego Flores and I was working in Pesaro in the Rossini Opera Festival, and we were both, I'm directing in Viaggio a Reims and he was singing, and he told me, we are going to do together La Fille du Régiment a Bologna. But I saw your production. It's terrible. We have to. We are very thin. We are very nice, and we have to do with this bibendum. And I say, well, that you have power to ask the theater, say that you want to do a new production, and we do another one. In fact, it happened that Juan Diego asked to do a new production, and we did it, that one that is now that you are going to see. And comparing the two productions, I in fact find more real, more realistic, and more nice the comedy, and with the spirit of where Donizetti write it in Paris, very French, very very light, that one than the other one that was in Napoleonic time. But also is unbelievable. Well, it's not there is a refrain in Spanish, was in Latin, explicatio non petita accusatio manifesta. No, if you say so many things explaining, is that you feel guilty. I don't feel guilty. I really don't feel guilty. I think you could believe it the same if we do it in Napoleonic times than in modern times. Yes,
I can't believe we've only got like 1 minute left, and I forgot to ask this question. Of course, it's about the most famous aria in the opera, and it's the A Mes Amis, the cabaletta of the double aria that Tonio sings when the regiment has finally given him permission to marry Marie. I'm not going to ask you about technique or whether it's difficult. It is unique. I don't know of any other aria for tenor where you have to produce 9 high Cs.
William Tell,
9 in one aria?
Right, almost 10, right? Yeah. Oh, Guillaume Tell is about 10, I think, and he has a C sharp in the aria and maybe 9 high Cs in the cabaletta.
And, of course, Guillaume Tell is a serious opera. This is a
37,
comedy.
37, right? 37 high Cs in the entire opera.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder, does it mean anything? I think that's what I want to ask you, is there a reason that this character sings 9 I see.
Well, when you sing 9 high Cs in an aria, you become very spiritual, I'll tell you that. but I don't know. I think it's just, it's his excitement in the 9 high Cs, which, you know, he's just gotten the approval of the regiment. So it's his excitement that's taking over, and I think that's the way you have to approach it when you're singing it. You just have to, you know, it's go for it and just let it go as if you were excited and trust that it will be there.
Well, we do. We trust that it will be there.
Thank you.
And we're very excited to see not only you, but everyone in this wonderful production. It's going to be delightful. Thank you very much to the panel, and thank you all for coming. We'll see you at the opera.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.